Welcome to the latest Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy, and my guest today is Jerry Toombs, CEO of ClearVision. Today we are talking about low-code and why businesses are increasingly adopting it as part of their digital transformation. Hello, Jerry.
Good day to you, Ian. My name is Jerry Toombs. I'm CEO, and I'm also head of what we call the Innovation Centre at ClearVision. If you haven't heard of us, we're an independent software tools specialist. We help organizations select, install, and maintain their platform of tools. We pride ourselves on being an independent vendor and helping customers, whether it be a best of breed tool or a single selection of tools. Atlassian, GitLab, Checkmarx, Mendix, etc., a whole bunch of tools.
We've seen a significant increase in the amount of low-code being used in organizations, especially in the last 18 months. Why is that, and how has it arisen?
For the listeners' sake, what I might just do is just explain very briefly the definition of low-code. Gartner do have a definition, which anyone can look up, and they refer to it as an application platform that supports rapid application development, deployment, execution, high-level abstract programming techniques. Now, behind all that, let's just really understand what it means. Everyone's familiar with the concepts of dragging and dropping. The whole point of low-code is that it takes the mystery out of programming. What we're not saying is that you don't need programmers, far from it. As we go through this, you know very well, this is not about removing programmers from the equation, absolutely far from it. This is about speeding up those programmers' efficiency, allowing them to do the boring parts more quickly and efficiently. But there is also what I would call the aspiring programmer, allowing them to be more, do more in a more technical stance than they could before. That's really where low-code comes in. Your question is about why has it launched itself in the last 18 months? I would say it goes back a little bit further than that. It's not a new technology. You've been around long enough. You've heard of RAD, haven't you?
I have.
As a concept, everybody's been striving for disrupting the programming world. I would say that this is that disruption. We see disruption happening around the world in all sorts of other industries. Low-code is at that kind of disruptive point. Why now? Well, because it's just reached that point of maturity. If you go back, I would say 2 years ago, you could probably count on two hands the number of true low-code vendors out there. And we'll come on to the topic of what really is low-code, because now what is there? There's claims to be 250, 300 people flouting the word low-code. But the true vendors are really seeing the opportunities now, because those customers are trying to get more efficiency out of the talent that they have in place.
You talked there about disrupting programming and RAD, but actually if we go back before RAD, we had the arrival of object orientation, was coding would become an assembly process. We'd have all these blobs of code, all these objects that we bring together, connect them, and that would create an application. But we still needed architecture, we still needed maturity in the process. What has changed to create that maturity that we can now begin to trust these assembly lines of blocks of code?
That's a really good question. What's changed quite a lot is that nearly everybody programs or produces APIs or connections, and they expose those to the world. The low-code platform that allows you to connect those exposed interfaces much more readily. It produces, as I said earlier, this concept of dragging and dropping. Everybody's familiar with using graphical tools where you drag and drop things and connect them. And that's the simplest way of explaining what low-code is. It demystifies the programming world such that other people don't have to spend 5 years being a designer, spend 5 years learning Java and understanding all the bits and bytes and all the complexity. It is now exposed with logic behind it. If you try and do something that's illogical, the tool then enables you to say, no, let's have another go. What you probably mean is this, that, and the other. But it really enables you to produce something with intelligence behind it. Whereas before, it's all in the human head as to how you still need to understand architects of databases. You still needed to know the depth of it to design it. And the beauty of this is the longevity as well. You know, once you design, and a bit like schematical drawings of a building, once you see it, you can start to get the different layers and pull them apart graphically.
How much has the expansion of things like macros in Excel helped this? People have now become used to the fact that you have a macro, it does a bunch of stuff, but you need to give it some parameters, which is the basics of programming. We now see people at all levels of organizations doing this. Has that played significantly into making it easier for people to understand, I have this object here, I've got this one here, and between the two, I need to just add some form of parameter. Has that simplified bringing people into this world?
I think that was the starting point. Dare I say, though, for those professional programmers, it was irrelevant to them. But for those, the industry tends to use the term citizen developers. I'm not a great lover of that term personally, because it suggests anybody can do it. And that's not the case. I prefer to use the word aspiring programmers. Without upsetting anybody, if you can imagine those people that have been web developers that had never quite made the capability, it was a little bit too far for them to be real high-level programmers. Now they can edge up that tree and become more advanced through the beauty of low-code.
But doesn't that roll us back to a challenge we've had for many years? We've had the role of a citizen developer for at least 25, 30 years that I can recall in this industry. The challenge has always been they'll put together something for them, or they'll put together something for their department or their team. But then when the rest of the enterprise wants to use it, it doesn't scale particularly well. What happened was IT were put in a position where they'd have to completely rewrite something, which would cause a lot of frustration between the person who originally put it together because they thought it was done, and IT who were saying, well, it's not enterprise ready. How much has low code removed that whole mess that occurred?
Another good question. This now brings us on to the differentiators between the top end of the market and the low end of the market. Let's talk about the low end. Like I mentioned earlier, there must be 200 odd vendors now using the term low code. Some of them are misappropriately using the term low code. There are simple platforms which are perfectly designed. Let's say you had a bright idea, Ian, and you wanted to create an application, whether it be an app for a phone or an application of larger sense. And you're a one-man band and you want to go to market with a great idea, there's absolutely a low-code platform out there for you. And maybe you and your colleague and just two or three of you want to co-develop in a short space of time. Perfect. There's loads of those out there. But I think what you were really referring to is the more higher-end applications. And this is where those better platforms, the ones that you see in the Gartner and Forrester top quadrants, where they have really understood that programming is not an isolated thing. This is about co-developing, and it has all of the things that you need for a team of people to co-develop together. Programming is not easy. This does not remove the challenges of different people working on different files and different logic areas of the program at different times. But as a platform, it takes away some of that complexity by understanding it's not only development, but it's deployment, it's execution, it's version control, it's change control. It is a platform. The good ones are a true software development platform, which allows you to control that complexity. Whereas in the early days, it was kind of missing that. You had the low code part, the programming bit, but it missed out the other bits that are now there.
One of the benefits of a platform is that platforms evolve. If we're going to talk about building these objects, how much does this play into the idea of automation? The end user knows what the process is that they do. One of our challenges from a development position has always been getting the end user to explain their process and producing something before that process changes.
Yes.
Are we now seeing a sufficient number of people beginning to develop a bit of automation, feeding it back into the platform, and then other people in the company taking that forward to build larger applications or newer, more complex pieces of automation?
The answer is yes, absolutely. But I think the significant change in the way in which we've seen a lot of consultancies operate now, it's not new, but we've this extreme programming concept. It's been around for many years. This really does allow you to have your customer or a number of customers sat next to you. They are the guiding force as to what they want to see and how it should operate. Because it is so quick to drag, drop and produce something and then click a button and run it and say, is that what you meant? As opposed to taking those ideas, sitting in a dark room, writing lines of code, and then going back and showing them a day later, this really does give you that capability of doing, let's say, 40% of that co-development with your end user in mind and potentially sat next to you. That's where that real quickness of that visualization for customers is sped up.
I'd like to go back to something you mentioned earlier, the issue of high end and low end. You could arguably say that my automating a task that I do every day is suitable for me. But how do I then begin to scale that into the enterprise and produce applications? Because some things will only work on the data platform we're using or the CRM platform, and that's all they're designed to do. Others, I need to operate at an enterprise level across multiple countries, across multiple products. Where does that begin to play into the IT departments and the operations teams thinking about low code?
This is what we're referring to earlier. This now becomes splitting hairs around the term low code. There are a number of vendors that have realized that this term low code is really a rapid growth and it's a great buzzword. And it's almost, unfortunately, detracting from what I would call the true low code vendors. As you mentioned, there are some vendors out there that have said, right, what I want to do is put this WYSIWYG platform graphical interface to my tool and only interfaces with my tool. It allows an admin to configure it quickly by dragging and dropping, but it only works on that platform, that particular tool. That's all it does. That's not low code. They've stolen the value of low code. What I tend to really refer low code to is when you are absolutely producing a software application of some kind. Then you can even start to distinguish between, I want to produce an app, it's something that might run on my phone. Then you might have larger enterprises that say, I've got a business challenge. I've got an ERP system. I might have just acquired another company, has a different ERP system. And what we've got to do is allow data from both systems to be drawn, manipulated, put back, and visualized. That is what's great about low-code systems, because it gives you those interfaces into these different systems. It allows you to extract it, present it, or manipulate it in whatever fashion you need, really quickly, really simply, visualize it maybe to a board of people, to a customer base, and then put it back wherever you need to. And that's what low-code can do really well as creating full-blown applications. Some of the best apps, SaaS systems that you see running today are built on low-code.
But if we were talking about traditional legacy systems, we'd wait for the IT department to write an integration from our low-code tool into that legacy system, or we'd hope that legacy vendor would provide it. We can't keep waiting for this stuff. So how many of those low-code platforms that you look at and that you deal with are investing in creating integrations into those legacy tools?
99% of them, that's their aspirations. For that top end, those enterprise ones that you see in the Gartner quadrants, Forrester quadrants, they are all about that. That whole concept of they recognize those IT departments as opposed to those software teams. Let's say, how can I put this nicely? Some of the highly skilled programmers look cautiously upon low code, almost in a threatening way. And they don't need to. Again, maybe we'll touch on that later, but they really don't need to. The IT teams are in a great soft spot. They don't feel threatened by this. How many IT teams, Ian, do you know that have a massive backlog of things that they just need to pick up, change, modify, put down again? So many IT teams are stuck with this growing backlog. And this is exactly what low code is ideally for. What you tend to get in an IT team is not your normal programmer, but you do have technically able, as I mentioned, aspiring programmers who are intelligent enough, they understand the principles of software, but they've never necessarily gone to the level of programming. Now they have that chance to be that more aspiring programmer in an IT team.
But part of that developer team resistance to low code is not so much about, oh, you're doing me out of a job. They're drowning under the amount of code they're being asked to write. Their concerns are about, how does this fit into my software lifecycle? How secure is this code? How bug-free is this code? Because we all know that no matter what you do, there are going to be errors in code at some point in time.
Absolutely, yes.
How do we overcome that resistance? Because you talked earlier about seeing change control and other elements that we would see as enterprise tools coming into the low-code platforms.
How do we overcome that? We are getting across the gap, the divide. And that's why, as you said, in the past 18 months, we are starting to see some of the vendors that we talk about in the top quadrant, not talking about RAD. This is low code is the next generation. But they've been around for 7-8 years. So that's quite a long time. But now we're starting to see that bell curve, that rapid takeoff. And I think this is driven partly because there's not enough clever technical people around. Companies are having to say, I need to use my resources better. Some of them are more prominent, more assertive, maybe is the better word, because they cannot find enough talent. There's just a world shortage. They're asking their technical teams to be more flexible. And when they start to see that this is not jeopardizing jobs and actually taking the mundane part out of their role, allowing them to be more creative and more thought-provoking where their skill sets are really required, most of them are saying, okay, you're right. I can see the benefit now. They're adopting it much quicker.
One of the challenges I see is the resistance. This isn't the way we do it. This isn't the enterprise tools that we use.
You're right. Let's not pretend you're going to throw out everything that you've got and replace it with a low-code platform. You're absolutely right, Ian. That's not the way to pitch a low-code platform. In your toolbox of tools, low-code is one of those tools. And it will become a larger tool, a multi-purpose tool. But we're not suggesting today that it replaces everything. Lots of companies, let me give you one example. They're heavily invested maybe in Atlassian Jira. They will keep that as their change control tool, even though a tool like Mendix might have change control built into it, but they'll integrate the two. So we're not talking about throwing stuff out. This is about adding as we invent new tools that make our life easier. This is one of those tools, but it will grow in its capabilities.
It opens up a whole bunch of other questions. For example, one of the things we talk about regularly with low code is the speed of development, the fact that we can iterate multiple times. But it's not just development here that we got to think about. You mentioned operations teams really early in this conversation, and so far we haven't touched on them at all. Operations teams always get the blame when a piece of code goes into production and something breaks. How are we going to bring operations teams with us in terms of trust and belief when they see citizen developers producing and iterating code, maybe not weekly, but certainly monthly in some environments?
At the end of the day, we're still dealing with humans here, and tools only respond as good as the humans. The point about this is that they are more sociable tools, they're more communication tools as well. Because if you think about visualizing, a lot of people react better to visual impressions, you know, when you can see something visually as opposed to lots of lines of code and you have to interpret it. If you bring those operation teams into the fold and they have a higher understanding of the visual layout and understanding of some of the tools of what you're developing, that helps them understand these changes that are flowing through. So instead of just getting, here's the latest bug fix, this is what it fixes, you can visualize and see that. The other beauty about this visual effect of it is if there is a mistake and it gets deployed and there's still a human error and mistake there, it is much easier than reading lines of code to come back into that model and make that correct change and redeploy again. It's quicker because you've got a wider audience of people that potentially could make that change because they understand the diagrams and pictures better than they understand having to read lots of lines of code. Once again, I'm oversimplifying something, but this is the way it's going. You will always need those clever programmers. They are doing the really advanced stuff. Low-code cannot do everything, and I'm not trying to pretend it can.
I mentioned earlier one of the advantages that I see of low-code is that users understand the process that they do and sometimes aren't very good at explaining it. One community that is often underserved but is becoming much more important because of the amount of developer time that it consumes is the highly technical area occupied by subject matter experts. Extracting that knowledge in order to add new automation and new applications into an organization can be incredibly time-consuming and taxing on everybody. Low-code seems to be an easy fit here where we take those people and we give them some training, we give them some skills, and we give them a platform. How mature are we on that journey, or is that a market that's only just starting to be understood?
I think you've just answered your own question, actually. I think you're literally correct. the opportunity is massive there for those people, again, to do that early staging of their ideas and to present it in a minimal form, such that the business people who hold the purse strings can say, okay, I see what you're getting at. I feel more comfortable than a description, which historically you do on a whiteboard or you do in a presentation. They're actually now getting that touching and feeling of those ideas in a much more living platform. But you're right. I don't think the low-code industry has really touched those people. And that is a massive opportunity for those people, those willing people at that level, if they're listening to this, to think, ah, I can see how I can get my ideas across much quicker. Guys, switch on to this because this is where you're going to shine.
Dev tools are never cheap. But when we start to scale up and talk about dev tools that are going to support everybody, part of the assumption is that this will all be open source code. The challenge with open source code when you bring it to enterprise is you need an enterprise-ready version of that code, a trusted, debugged version of that code, that platform. What are you seeing happening with pricing and licensing at the moment?
If there was a part of this industry that's changing most, it's that area. What have we seen change? I won't give away the vendors' names because they're all doing it, in actual fact. But not only are they realizing the competitive nature of this market, the growth in the last 2 years has been massive in terms of the number of vendors that are claiming to be in the low-code world. There's high competition coming this way. So there's nothing stopping this. This is the future, without a doubt. The train is rolling fast. What worked 18 months ago in terms of a licensing price and a licensing model is no longer working, Ian, today. We've seen some vendors change their model to adapt to exactly what you said. How can they charge? Some charge per programmer, some charge based upon amount of code. They're all scrabbling now to find the best, most economical model that works, considering, is it based on end users? Is it based on people that design it? Is it based on programmers? I'm not sure that we've seen the end of this yet.
I was going to say there's a challenge in this, isn't there? If we look at how cloud has reshaped the whole licensing model, software is offered much cheaper and it's offered on subscription. And then there are little things you can continue to add to increase the size of your subscription and functionality. How do the asset management teams get control of this pricing and this risk of this suddenly becoming too widespread in an organization such that it becomes out of control?
I wish I had an answer for you, Ian. These changes in relative terms have been forced on these low-code vendors because they're all competing. This is that land grab time. Once you tend to align yourself with one of these vendors, you're probably going to stick with it because lifting and shifting your model between vendors, well, that's going to take export-import capabilities, which I just don't think any of the vendors are there and perhaps not even interested in. This land grab is taking place. And I don't think they've paused. I think they're running so fast to make sure that they provide enough flexibility. And they're still reshaping these licensing models. I think there's more to come, Ian. I really do. I wish I was the expert here and on the inside of some of these vendors. I'm sure there's some really interesting conversations going on about how they are going to mature this licensing. And indeed, as you just said, there's so many different people to care about. And I'm not sure there's a model that cares for everybody.
And that brings us back to something we touched on at the beginning but haven't really talked about, talent.
Oh, my favorite.
Where do we find the talent to drive our low-code plans forward?
I have a real soft spot for this because one of the areas that ClearVision is doing a lot of work on is the whole world of talent. First of all, doesn't matter what IT company you are, what space in technology you're in, there is not enough clever technical talent in the globe. And we're now reaching further afield. And in some respects, the very fact that more companies are open to remote talent is a great thing. The pandemic's not been great for the world, but in one area, it has opened our eyes up to spreading our wings further afield to look for talent. But that talent isn't matured in some parts of the world. There's available talent. It's a bit like, as I say, that aspiring developer. That's where I think low code helps because the talent is out there in pockets, but it's not matured enough. To get them to the maturity of high level programmers in a short space of time, it's just going to take time. Whereas you can teach them low code in a much shorter time and get them up the rungs of the ladder quicker.
But surely this is where we find ourselves in a bit of a conundrum here. Here we are talking about talent and the need to have people who can do this stuff. But at the same time, we're talking about a platform that's designed to be simple, easy to use, to attract the citizen developer, the self-taught developer into this world. Where do we find that balance between bringing on people internally, between allowing people to learn and going out and actively seeking and getting into a price war with our competitors over talent?
The world of supply and demand, it controls everything. I don't have a magic wand here. I actually have a very personal, fundamental view on the way the world is changing here. I think the day of employing, and this is a bit far out there now, but the way of employing lots of people, I think is going to change. I think we're going to see these pop-up pools of talent almost forming its own unity where companies can then go and hire a little pod of talent wherever it might be, or we'd be bringing together. I'm probably giving away some of my business ideas now, but the important real point here is that we can bring this remote talent to productivity much quicker. There's two parts to this. If you remember earlier, we spoke about the smaller low-code platforms. Those people that have an idea, it's been in their head for a long time, and they want to get it to market, this is just going to enable those people, those kitchen developers, those garage developers, to come to market with those bright ideas much quicker. Those enterprise companies will be fishing in a larger market, but this is still going to be competitive in. It's not going to go away. Maybe just for a period of time, they're going to change the way in which they enable those people.
But here's a challenge with that. If I outsource my code writing, one of the concerns is I lose control, particularly of quality. With low code, we're talking about objects, some of which may be very bespoke and specific to my business. How do I create a distributed environment so that I can outsource securely and protect the IP that I've put into building those objects to get the solutions I want in the timescale I need?
The traditional term outsource means you tend to find a company to outsource to. I think this is going to change. So instead of employing people, there is this outsourcing concept to another company. I think there's a different model. I think it's a bit like open source community. I think we're going to start to see, especially with the younger generation, they all want to go to London, New York. They just don't want to live there permanently. I think this younger community is able to form pods of which you hire the pod, still with accountability, responsibility, and so forth. They feel part of your organization whilst not being fully employed. I think there's a dynamic here which the world is going to change to. And we're going to try and encourage that at Clear Vision. That's one of the things that we're working on. It might be a bit far-fetched, but companies have to change to embrace this shortage of talent. And I think this is one of the changes that we're going to see. The low-code platforms help that, because the platform unites people in a consolidated way. It doesn't allow them to work in their own locations with their own isolated bunch of code. You are still collaboratively working together.
It'll be interesting to see how much the pandemic will accelerate that as an adoption. But let me put you on the spot here for a minute. Let's say you're in a room when we get back to being in big rooms, and there's all these people looking at you, and they want you to give them the top three things they can go away to start implementing low-code plans throughout their business to gain some of these benefits. What are you going to say to them?
First thing I would say, just be cautious of the word low-code. Do your homework carefully, because the low-code term has been slightly wrongly used or misinterpreted. So just be very conscious of what kind of organization you are and what it is that you need from rapid development. Then I would say, if you're an enterprise-sized company, ensure you buy something that has that scalable capability. Remember, it's not a replacement for everything. That's far from it. It will evolve. But as you mentioned, IT teams, true software development teams, operation teams, you need something that involves them all. So you're going to the top part of the Gartner and Forrester quadrants to do that. Proper platforms, collaborative platforms. The last point, it's going to come back to talent. When you are making your decision about a low-code platform, just be conscious about the amount of materials the vendor has to support that learning exercise so that those aspiring developers can get up to speed quicker. Not all of those low-code platforms have great learning environments because you still need to learn it. Some of them are standout. Some of the vendors out there are incredible in terms of how they provision and help and stand up environments and give you guided tools. They've really thought about it. They've actually used low-code to develop the low-code training platform.
I think in 10 years, we'll be looking back and we'll be wondering why we ever discussed why should we use low-code, because we're going to see a shift where it will become the dominant form of coding for an awful lot of automation and applications going forwards.
I think this is the Uber of the software world. Ordering your cab has never been the same. Developing software will never quite be the same.
Jerry, thank you for talking with me this morning.
Ian, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.